Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 319. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go to that Facebook, type in thisshowisogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have two incredible guests on this week's show. We must get started with the first one. Seth Sykes is an actor, a performer, a director, an entertainer. He has performed to sold-out shows all over the frickin' place. He's served as an assistant director on incredible shows like The Nance, Tribes, and Pageant. His show, Seth Sykes Sings Mostly Judy Garland, will be at 54 Below. We just keep talking about 54 Below every single week. New York City's 54 Below. It will be there on Friday, September 18th. You can stroll on over to 54below.com to check out tickets. But before you do that, let's talk to him. Seth, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a treat to have you. We have so much ground to cover. Seth, are you ready?
Oh my God, I hope so.
Okay, I'm going to just trust that you are, and we're going to wing it if you're not.
Okay.
All right. Is there a label to which you gravitate towards? Performer, director, entertainer? What resonates with you?
Well, it's funny. You know, I hadn't been on stage in 10 years before I did the first of these Judy Garland Garland concerts. And now, within the year, I'm doing my fifth one.
Wow.
And I've certainly got the bug. Suddenly, I'm a singer.
Nice.
So I guess I would gravitate lately to singer.
All right. Well, we're going to talk all about Judy Garland. We're going to talk all about the show. But we never talk about directing. We rarely, if ever, talk about directing on this show. What does an assistant director do?
Assistant director does everything from get coffee for the director to rehearse understudies to put in replacements to maintain a show if it's in a long run. It can be very menial and it's often, you know, sometimes exciting.
What's the ratio of menial to exciting? I'm hoping it's, you know, 20-80.
menial to exciting, probably, it depends on the director, but I'd say more like 30-70.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not so bad. I like the majority that's exciting.
It's often very exciting, and I've got to work with really great directors.
I would imagine that working with these director styles has helped you develop your own style of directing.
Yes, absolutely. I haven't actually directed all that much on my own. I've done a lot of benefits and things, but mostly I've worked in as assistant. But absolutely, the directors that I worked with influence my approach to everything. I think even singing, absolutely. I think that I like when things are approached with a certain amount of honesty.
Yeah.
And so I try to do song with a certain amount of honesty, as if I was, you know, picturing that. If a director I respected was there directing me, I would, you know, do it the way that they like me to.
Nice. Well, walk me through. You're behind the scenes. You're hanging out, you know, doing barely anything menial and everything exciting. And at some point you say, well, gosh, I need to be back on stage.
Sort of. So, you know, I went to acting school, but I don't really think of myself as an actor. But singing has always been something I have been missing a lot for the last 10 years since, like, you know, acting school and high school choir. And the way that I got the singing out of my system is what I call a piano bar addict.
Yes.
I spent a lot of my time, and I mean a lot of my nights, at piano bars.
Nice.
And while I was, you know, assistant directing a show here or there, doing all my day jobs, I would go out at night and sing around the piano with all these people. And at one point, I got the nerve to get up and sing a Judy Garland song. And I realized, my God, like, okay, I can really connect to these songs. And people really responded. So I started learning them, you know, one by one. And it was really the response in the piano bars that got the nerve to get up and do the show.
What was the song? We need to know which song you got up there and did.
The first song was, there were two. I think the very first one I started doing was The Man That Got Away.
Okay.
Do you know it?
I, of course, know it. Come on, man.
Well, I don't know how much of a Judy fan you are.
We're going to talk about that. Let's just go right into it, because the question, of course, we have to ask, do we feel it is required for the gays to know the Judy? Because I feel like maybe I don't know as much as I should.
Do I think it's required that gay people should know Judy?
I think we should require it, just so that...
I think it should absolutely be required.
Tell us why.
Oh, it's so difficult to... I don't know. Well, you know what? I don't like the whole thing of, you know, she was so tortured, we're so tortured. I don't really like that. I sort of like the idea, and it's a simple one, is that gay guys do tend to have great taste, and her talent was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, that ever lived, and it's almost impossible to escape that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
There's also a rawness to it that... again, I don't know why gay people would respond to the rawness.
You know, I would hate to think that it is the torture thing. I think there is the piece that's like, oh, it was a life not fully realized. You know, certainly there was the camp factor, but then there was also the sense that she could have done even more than she did, and maybe also didn't get the recognition that critically that post, you know, her death that people thought she should have gotten. So it's hard to parse out for people, especially people like you and me, and not to out your age, but neither one of us was alive when she was really alive, you know?
No. The thing is that I didn't know, when I first discovered Judy, I didn't know about all of the torture, the drugs, the early death. I didn't know about all that. I knew her because we had a VHS tape of Summer Stock in my hometown in Paris, Texas. In my house, for some reason, my aunt had a copy of it, and I watched it religiously, and I fell in love with her, that woman, and that voice, and I knew that, you know, that was it for me. I learned, of course, all about the legend later, but I don't think, for me as a little boy, my attraction to her had to do with, you know, the torture and all of that.
Yeah. How did you comb through her catalog to decide what you wanted to perform?
Well, it's all about Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
This surprises people. There are still some Judy movies I haven't seen. I've seen most of them. I'm not, I have an encyclopedic knowledge of them.
Right.
But it's the live stuff that really got me later, especially in the last couple of years. So, like, when I would go through a heartbreak or a love affair or something, and I would start to listen to like one track at Carnegie Hall, like Stormy Weather or something. And I couldn't believe how emotional it was and how much I connected with it.
Yeah.
And then I started singing them in the piano bars. But the point to answer your question is, it was really the Carnegie Hall stuff that I wanted to, you know, and most of my show, the previous show, I'm changing it up a little bit, was Carnegie Hall. Although there are several things that aren't Carnegie Hall.
Now, there's a little bit of a switch. You know, it was originally titled Seth Sykes Sings Judy Garland, and then the word mostly has been inserted in there. Talk to us about that word mostly.
So, you know, a lot of people, a lot of critics, and a lot of people keep saying, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? And yet, there are a lot of people in New York who haven't seen the Judy Garland thing. So... September 18th was going to be just another Judy Garland show, and I was going to put in just a lot of new Judy songs. But the club has come back and asked me to do a series, and the series you do has to sort of remain the same. So we just recently changed it to Seth Sykes Sings Mostly Judy Garland, and I just thought it would be fun, especially because I have some repeat audience member, to do some things that are not Judy Garland. However, they are all... other women songs.
Okay. All right. When people, not if, but when people get tickets to go see you, Friday, September 18th, New York City's 54 Below, they watch you up there. You are in control of the experience that they have. What do you want them to walk away feeling?
I actually want them to walk away feeling like they should go home and listen to Judy Garland.
Nice.
I really think that she changed my life a couple of times. One was growing up in Texas. My obsession with her fueled my interest in theater, which got me to New York. And then after, you know, not being on stage for a long time, my obsession with her once again got me on stage.
and people are excited by that. But so I want to keep her alive. And if people leave the show and go home and watch, you know, her videos or listen to her albums, then I think I've sort of done my job.
Nice. I love that. Now, we've decided to play a little game with you, which we haven't played in quite some time, where we're going to give you the opportunity, Seth, to do a little psychoanalysis of yourself based on some Judy Garland songs that we know that you perform. So we're going to name a couple songs. We're going to name a couple songs for you, and you're going to tell us what you think they say about Seth Sykes. You ready?
Okay.
All right. Let's start with an easy one. What about Get Happy? What do we think Get Happy says about Seth?
Get Happy. There's a difference in sort of how I put it in the show.
Yeah.
And what it actually means for me. I don't know. Get Happy is the most iconic Judy Garland moment, arguably. And she sounds so pure that it's the essence of joy. So to try to sing that arrangement, I know that me singing it has anything to do with the purity of her sound, but I can almost feel her. I can almost channel her energy. I can almost feel her coming out of me. Now, what it says about me, I don't know. I haven't figured that out.
Okay.
That's a very good question.
That's okay. That's okay, because we're going to make you do one more. This one's a little bit easier. I'm thinking this one's a little bit easier. All right. What about I Got Rhythm? What do we think I Got Rhythm says about Seth Sykes?
It means everybody look at me because I'm a star.
There it is. I love it. So you're going to get up on stage. We've already established what the audience is going to feel. How are you going to feel up there?
Well, each time it got a little easier. The first time was absolutely terrifying. I mean, again, I haven't been on stage in 10 years. You know, I was shaky. The second one got a little better. The third one, I started to have fun. And the fourth one, I was completely relaxed.
Nice.
But the thing is, I don't get to do it very often. It's every, you know, 2 or 3 months. So who knows? And now that I'm doing a lot of new songs, I think they'll be a little bit more scared. But every time I get up there, I get more and more comfortable. So I'm hoping I get up there and relax.
Yeah.
Because when I'm relaxed, I'm at my best.
Nice. How do you feel that you have evolved as a performer? You know, you obviously are getting more and more comfortable being up there and you're getting rave reviews all over the place. How are you continuing to evolve and challenge yourself?
Well, part of it is staying in shape vocally.
Yeah.
I can tell a huge difference in just what I'm able to do because I'm singing all the time and rehearsing. And the other thing is actually what you just said before, was nerves. The more comfortable you get, the more I'm able to disappear into a song. So it's just like anything else, practice.
All right, well, this is coming up. Listeners, everybody needs to stroll on over to 54below.com and get your tickets. And maybe we could just stroll out one night and just find you at a piano bar, it sounds like.
You could. That version would be free.
I would love that. So what would we be singing together there at the Duplex?
Oh, well, we could all... If you want to get away from Judy, Sondheim's always good with me.
Oh, see, can you help me with that? My Sondheim appreciation is just not there.
Oh, no.
I know.
We can't be friends. I can teach you.
I would welcome that. I don't know that I'm allowed in the Duplex anymore, but, you know, if we could find another place, it would be great.
Oh, no, what did you do at the Duplex?
It's possible I got fired from the Duplex. It doesn't matter. These things happened in the past. It's all good.
My piano bar of choice is a funny one. I don't know if you ever go, but it's the Townhouse.
I've never been.
You must go to the. We must go to the Townhouse.
Done. We're done. We're going to go to the Townhouse. Everybody, you can join us there. Also, please go to 54below.com and buy tickets to see Seth Sykes sings mostly Judy Garland Friday, September 18th. Seth, looking forward to seeing you up there.
I can't wait to see you out there.
Forget your trouble.
Happy days.
Come on, get happy.
I'm here again.
The skies.
All our cares
above are clear.
Again.
Shout hallelujah.
So let's sing a song.
Come on, get happy.
Cheer again.
Get ready.
Happy days are here.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we actually have our second guest live with us sitting right here, right next to me, right this very second. M. Carmen Lane is a poet and a cultural worker. Carmen's work has been published in Red Ink Magazine, the Yellow Medicine Review, and Carmen is a contributor to the Lambda Literary Award-nominated anthology Sovereign Erotics, a collection of two-spirit literature. Carmen's new book, Calling Out After Slaughter, is an incredible collection of poems. It is in my hand right this very second. We're going to get Carmen to read some of these poems right here in my dining room. Carmen, welcome to this show with So Gay.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you here. All right, we have a lot of ground to cover. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Carmen, what does being a poet mean to you?
I think for me, being a poet is about getting to the root of things.
Nice.
Particularly in my own self. And if I can practice coming into some kind of contact with my own self, then perhaps I can be useful to others.
Wow, I love that. Now, if I reach out to your family, what is the earliest poem that I can find that you have written?
I don't know the earliest poem. I know that my mother gave me a copy of it. It was the fourth grade.
Yes.
You know, it was on the wall during a parent-teacher conference or whatever you call that day, but she saved it.
Where is it right now?
It's in storage.
Okay. Emotional storage? Actual storage?
An actual storage facility.
Do you remember the content? Is it in this book? I feel it's in this book.
No, it isn't. I don't recall the content. But and then the earliest poem that I still know the words to, I wrote when I was 12.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What's that one? You don't have to do the whole thing, but I want the title.
Oh, it's very short. I call it C is for colonization.
There it is. It's so funny that you said the ones that you know the words to. As I was reading through this anthology, and we've had a few poets on the show over the years, there's writing poetry, and then there's also that part where you stand up in front of people and read it aloud. Those seem to be two very different skills to me.
They are.
Yeah.
I think that there is, you know, writing is solitary, but there is an art to being in relationship with an audience reading your work.
Nice.
And that you get feedback in ways that you don't get feedback when you send your writing out to be published. You know, it's either a yes or it's a no. But you simultaneously have a group of people being impacted in all kinds of ways, and they let you know.
Right then and there.
Right then and there.
Have you had any highlights of just being up there and you've just gotten such a great response that you're like, yeah, that one hit it?
Yeah, I think there was a poem, it's in the book, that I wrote about Trayvon Martin. And there was a substantial group of, you know, African American Black folks in the audience, and it was nice that it wasn't just that the poem resonated, that it felt like it was something that we as a community needed to hear in the moment.
Wow.
You know, so I was appreciative of that.
What's your craft style? Do you go off in a room by yourself? When you mentioned it's a solitary experience for you, is there a consistent way that you create?
Well, I wrote poetry for a long time and then stopped for many, many years. And then I went to graduate school, and the first academic scholarly paper I submitted for grad school, the feedback that I got from the professor was that my writing was puffy.
Huffy.
Yes, that was the word Catherine used. And so I ended up engaging in a process of writing poems that were intentionally stark and intentionally kind of getting to the heart of what I wanted to say. And after, you know, several years of graduate school, you know, there was this body of work. And so doing the creative first made room for the scholarly.
Yeah. And puffy.
Puffy, yes. Catherine Farquhar.
It sounds like you have an okay relationship with Catherine these days.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. She's awesome.
I cannot wait until classes start next week because I'm totally going to describe a student's writing as puffy.
Puffy.
I don't even know what it means.
I don't know what it means either. Yeah.
What would you say generally across the board inspires you to write?
My intuition. I would say that there's an urging that emerges for me, and if I don't attend to it, it impacts me physically. And if I don't attend to the urging, I lose the poem.
Wow.
It's gone. And so that is a loss.
Yeah.
It's a deep loss, I think, for me and for anybody who is a creative person. And I think most people are creative. And so if there are moments where you get an urging and you don't attend to it, you know, the world is missing out, you know?
Now, I have a stereotype of you, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong.
Ooh, tell
I know.
Me.
Here
tell
we go.
Tell me your stereotype.
I have you pegged as a pen-to-paper type of poet.
No.
No?
No.
Not
I,
right?
I use a laptop.
Look at you.
Okay.
I
have sketchbooks that I used to write poetry in.
Okay.
And there's something about where... Well, I'm a visual artist, too. But I like writing in paper that doesn't have lines, but that probably translates into a Word document that doesn't have lines. So it's probably a similar attraction in terms of a blank page than becoming no longer blank.
I love that. What would you say distinguishes... Now, we're going to have you read some poems in a little bit, but I'm not telling you which ones.
Okay.
I have the pages dog-eared. What would you say distinguishes... an M. Carmen Lane poem. If someone read it and they said, oh, that's so clearly, that's what it is.
I would say there's probably an aesthetic that's quite elegant and beautiful, and yet it's uncomfortable.
Nice. That actually leads right into the next question. So there is that. I mean, again, they're going to hear your poems, and there is that element of, oh, okay, this is not about sunshine and rainbows, and nor would it be appropriate for it to be about sunshine and rainbows, for particularly for someone who's a cultural worker who has a sense of everything going on. What do you want someone, if you could control, which we know that we can't do, we know we can't control everyone's reaction, but for the purposes of This Show Is So Gay, if you wanted to control your reader's reaction, what do you want them to walk away with?
A clarity of what they need to do in the world.
Action-based.
And it could be internal. You know, maybe a particular shift that they need to make. Or a way of showing up that needs to be tweaked a little bit. But if someone feels as if their own voice becomes clearer as a result of reading the voice of someone else, then... That's great.
That's a beautiful thing. That's not just great. That's amazing.
And it's certainly been my experience in poetry. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I came of age in the era of, you know, poets like Christos and Audre Lorde and Gloria Anzaldúa and Beth Brandt and Pat Parker, you know. So these are people who helped me hone my vision, helped me make meaning around what I was seeing in my own life. And in my own environment. And so I think those types of opportunities are not as readily available right now in the world.
I would like more of those opportunities.
Yes.
Would you say, so we have kind of what we want people to walk away with, we have your style. Do you think there's a narrative thread that connects every poem you've written?
Yes and no. So it's interesting, right, to... write something individually. It's another thing to engage in a process of creating a whole. So this is my first collection. So other people have probably much more insight than I do about it. But for me, I'm curious, and I would love to hear it from you, given that you had the opportunity to read it as a thing in and of itself, versus, you know, kind of piecing it together. Yeah. I think there is a theme around being at the core of our origins, our original dynamic, our original purpose, our original way of being and doing in the world.
Yeah. I tend to hone in on, I hope this is not the most inane piece of this whole process.
No.
I'm a little worried about this question.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that the order of the poems in the book is important.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I probably was more focused on what the first and last poems were going
right.
to be.
Ooh, that had to have been hard.
Yes. I gave myself some leeway around the center, the middle section.
Nice. I love
it. I'll be honest about that, right?
How does it feel just on the most basic level that you're looking at me right now and I am holding this book of poetry that you created? It's your first collection. It's right here. It's in my hands, which doesn't make for good radio, but
right.
What does that evoke in you?
Well, looking at you hold the book evoked in me a conversation I had with the publisher about the size of the book.
Oh.
So originally the book was going to be thinner, like a 5x8, and that's smaller and a little bit more intimate. And we talked about my own desire around the book being something that people wanted to carry with them and take with them places and put it in their bag or put it in their pocket or whatever. And, you know, I'm still taking it in that that's a thing right there, you know, that you're holding that, you know, I had a friend who was very supportive around kind of the 11th hour type decisions around the book. And so I'm very grateful to Rain for that. And, I think it is interesting to birth something, whether it's a creative project or a human being. And so it became a birthing process for me to the point where I was having physical stuff because writing is excruciating. It's excruciating.
It's right here in my
It's
hand.
Right here in your hands.
All right, we got to get to you reading
okay.
some of these. I'm quite excited. So again, listeners, we are here with M. Carmen Lane, poet extraordinaire. I have dog-eared. We're going to meet in the middle. We're going to meet in the middle on this. So you open up to whatever dog-ear you would like. I've read everything. You certainly have written everything. So if there's one that jumps out at you that you think, okay, listeners, this is the one that they need to hear first, because we're going to make you do a couple.
Okay.
You know, and none of these are the 12-year-old poems. These are, it's a whole different breed.
Yeah, it's grown folks' poems.
Grown folks' poems. Yes.
Okay, so I will read Contrary first.
That's my favorite one.
my friend Scott, it's his favorite one, too. Contrary is an indigenous concept of, and it comes out of a specific tradition, but I don't want to get that incorrect. But I do want to talk about the concept of what it means to be called to walk in a way that is not in alignment with the rest of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so particularly I wrote this for Two-Spirit people, but I think in general, it speaks to my own belief around being disinterested in assimilation as a queer person.
Nice.
And that...
That's a thing.
It is a thing.
Yeah.
And that I think that we need to be more curious about our purpose as queer people and not so much into what a society that isn't interested in seeing the things that they don't want to see.
Right.
And that, in fact, that is our job as queer people. And that some of us do that job very well. And some of us resist it. So, anyway, contrary, not like those who oppress us. We do not grow, but shed. Our purpose is not to nurture a thicker skin, but to slough off the layers, residue of a myopic ilk demanding we shrink into their tiny frame. Not like those who have maimed us. We must release what is we have spent too long a time speaking truth to power. Waiting with bated breath for the bulimic purge of their treachery. This is not our work, but the call of those who mutilate. We are contrary. Ancestors beckon us to walk backward into infinite possibility, dance unclothed into a realm of unknowing, crushing old adages, remembering instead sacred knowledge unfit for the printed page, heathen speech, malarkey, divergent and incomprehensible gibberish of a threatening savage. You, me, we are a perverse and spirit-willed people. Our axis tilts with our mother. Contrary to this crooked line of democracy, no straightening up needed. Instead, a slow unwrapping of white gauze, a consult with bear for old medicine, allowing a contrary wind to heal our wounding.
Sacred knowledge unfit for the printed page.
That's who we are.
Yeah. All right. I love that one. I love that one. So many contrary winds out there.
Yes. Yes.
We could name them, but, you know, we're not that kind of show.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to make you do one more. I'm going to make you do one more.
One more from your...
No, you can go off of...
No, I will pick one that... Well, my birthday is Friday.
Yes. How could I not dog-ear that
yes,
one?
Yes, yes. And then...
I'm totally outing you. M. Carmen Lane turning 22 yet again this Friday.
Again
I love
Friday.
It.
Friday. But, you know, this one is short and sweet.
Do that one. Oh, yeah. You're doing both.
Okay. Do both?
Yeah.
Okay. So this one is called At 40, which is the, you know, hashtag real age. I don't know if it's really accurate because I'm not 40 until Friday, but there's a process of getting
there.
To 40.
Yeah.
You know, so perhaps that's the side name of the poem is Getting to 40.
Getting to 40.
So at 40, there are things no longer perceived by your human eyes. Elders have become spirit. Responsibilities have shifted to the no longer young. There are possessions that remain, left dusty in that same spot. Habits, call to an old lover better left behind. Fears reflecting faces of little black men, confusion and unrelenting guilt, vicious misery from our masters. They will never bend. They must be broken. At 40, memories creep up for one more viewing before the wake. Rapist who turned you into mother. Rage that transforms stomach into a knot, throat into cannon. At 40, you remember theory, now newfound wisdom. Jackie said, one is not born a woman of color, you become one. New old meanings shift with molested landscape. Reside as mystery, internal battles benefit those without courage. Afraid, we will see but never name their cowardice. Patterns become normative. Our relatives who take a position of ignorant discount their history of captivity. You are but a link in the welder's ongoing project. Hate you for seeing both chains and possibility. If women who are transgender are indeed women, what does it mean for women to call themselves allies? If butch women are women, what does it mean when you call them trans? If black lives matter, why are black men the only lives we protect in need of shielding? At 40, you learn there are answers no one wants to name. For to speak them into being would mean you have changed.
Shouldn't I be snapping? In my head, I am.
Tell me more about
right
your snap.
Now.
Tell me more about that.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Well, you have one more. You
one
have
more?
One more to do, yes. You can't not read that one.
Yes.
You know exactly which one I'm talking
yes.
about.
Yes, I do. White lesbian supremacist.
Yes.
Anything... she says, is a go, because she done gone through some shit, is an ally, fights the real racists. So, what? You better take it.
White, lesbian.
Supremacist.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We've met her.
We've met her. We've met her. I think we had her on the show once. So there's that. There's that. Well, I have to ask you one more. Can we go off away from poetry for 2 seconds?
Yes.
One of the amazing things about your life that I love hearing about dovetails with a narrative thread that we try to talk about often on this show over the past 7 years, but never really get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about intergenerational connections.
Yes.
And, you know, I know that a big part of your life is caring for elders.
Yes.
And it's something that I would put out there in the gay community, we suck at. You know, the knowledge passing down. And, you know, look, there's that whole piece where we don't necessarily share a queer identity with our biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
So we have those families of choice.
Right.
That said, the intergenerational work, I find, just isn't there to the degree we need it to be. As someone who is involved in intergenerational contact, what are we missing out on?
Mm. I think we are missing out on understanding our own selves.
Mm.
As I think that when a community who I would even venture say is not a community.
Right. Then there's that. Yeah.
Then there's that. You know, part of, I think, from an Indigenous standpoint, being a community is having some kind of land base.
Mm.
Right. And so we are choosing to create an intentional community based on a shared experience of living in a system that does not want us to exist. The same society does not want old people to exist. And so we are missing out on potential allies.
Mm.
We are missing out on the opportunity to hear and feel and take in an experience of being loved unconditionally by cis people, by straight people, by white people, by Christian people who are at a place in their human development where they are just being human beings and where they are no longer in their roles. Elders are in a place where they get to be Nancy, Jane, not granddad and husband and all of those things. We also miss the opportunity to challenge and be challenged for things that are easily not attended to when we are in our bubbles, people who we hope share the same beliefs.
Yes.
And being in community is around being with people who have different beliefs, but still being connected.
Yeah.
And so we're fooling ourselves.
We're moving in the same direction.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. We're fooling ourselves into thinking that divergent viewpoints aren't necessary for our safety, for our strength, and for our liberation.
I love it. I love it. More contact, more contact.
Yes.
Hey, if someone's listening, not if, when a listener hears all this and they say, well, heck, I want a copy of Calling Out After Slaughter, where do they go?
They can get it from a Guide to Culture bookstore.
Nice.
They have a website, Guide to Culture, G-U-I-D-E, to, and culture. This is the tricky part, K-U-L-C-H-U-R.
Nice. And we're going to link to that as well.
Yes. So the link will be with the radio show.
Yes,
so.
It will. Yes, it will. What do you got coming up? Are we doing readings? What are we doing? Is there going to be a reading at the party on Friday?
There may be a reading at my birthday party on Friday. There will be an opening when Guide to Culture Bookstore and Press opens their new doors. They're expanding at this point. And I definitely am in conversations about what it means to be on tour and coming to people's communities and sharing this book and, you know, creating kind of frameworks for conversations about where we are,
I love that.
You know, here and now in our world. And there's so much happening in our world.
So what I hear you saying is that you want me to come to the party on Friday dressed as a lesbian supremacist. Did I get that wrong?
No, not at all. Not at all. But that, you know, we simply know that there's some possibilities around how we collude in that relationship and we can show up and be different, you know.
Yet another individual who is highlighting that there is more work to be done by using their individual voice. Carmen, what a treat having you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, folks, and We are back. Well, we certainly have some time left on this week's episode, so we will be covering all the latest LGBT news out there. But first, that announcement that we've been waiting to make, a whole new project for all of us who work here on This Show Is So Gay. We are actually launching a web series. We are trying to get the funding together to launch a web series inspired by one episode of This Show Is So Gay that we tried to work on but weren't super successful, and it involved reaching out to my high school bullies to try to get them on the air. And although I was not successful in getting them on the air, the whole process of seeking out my high school bullies was just so incredible and so enriching and helped me work through a lot of experiences. And even putting it out there on social media, it just got a flood of responses. So it got me thinking, well, what if we got people together with their high school bully and they sat down for tea? And they sat down for a cup of coffee. They just sat down together. So all of that led to this new project. It's called The Bully Pulpit. And you can stroll on over to Kickstarter.com and you can type in the search engine The Bully Pulpit and our project will come right up. We've only just started fundraising. Our goal is to raise $10,000. We're already almost 20% there, which is very exciting. We still have more than 30 days left. So if you are in a position to contribute in any way, which could include just sharing the link, or if you are somehow able to give between $10 and $10,000, whatever you want to do, any help would be amazing. Watch the video there on that site. We worked really hard on it. It's going to give you a good sense of what we're trying to work on. It's only 2.5 minutes long. I am asking you for 150 seconds just to check out our video there at Kickstarter.com. Type in The Bully Pulpit. It'll come right up. There's a cool logo designed by the same folks who designed the This Show Is So Gay logo, which we have enjoyed for 7 years. It's Switch FX. It's a great company there in New York City. So you will see the logo come up of The Bully Pulpit with two tin cans tied together by a piece of string. And whatever you can contribute, whatever you can do, we're just looking to diversify what it is that we do here at This Show Is So Gay. And it's a project that we really believe in. We really believe if we can get people together with their bullies, some amazing things can happen and catharsis is possible. So again, Kickstarter.com, type in The Bully Pulpit. It'll come right up. Let's get to the news. There is a new study out there that says that women are more likely to be bisexual than men. Look at that. Researchers say this from the University of Notre Dame. The researchers found that men were more likely than women to report being 100% heterosexual or 100% homosexual continually throughout their lives. Women, on the other hand, were 3 times more likely than men to report a shift in their sexual orientation over time and more likely to identify as bisexual. The study uses data from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health, which tracked the sexual activity of over 5,000 women and 4,000 men as they age. So there you go. Women, apparently, more likely to be bisexual than men. Who knew? Who knew? But that is not all that this study says. Apparently, this research, which was presented to the American Sociological Association, it has caused controversy. So while it again argues that, or research has determined, I should say, that women are more likely to be bisexual than men, it also indicated that attractive and educated women may be more likely to say they are 100% heterosexual. The idea was put forth by Dr. Elizabeth Ora McClintock, again of Notre Dame. She said that attractive women are, quote, initially successful in partnering with men early in life and are therefore more likely to never explore alternative sexual identities. If women's sexuality is fluid, then their identity will allegedly be shaped more by experience and context. In this case, the experience and context is allegedly vastly greater success attractive women have with men. Look at that. So again, not just that women are more likely to be bisexual, but the study indicates that attractive and educated women may be more likely to say they are 100% heterosexual. So as you can imagine, and SheWire.com highlights this as well, the implications that straight women are prettier than queer women and that women who identify on the queer spectrum are more desperate, well, that has blown social media up with both rage and poignant humor. One commentator on The Independent highlighted the limitations of relying solely on self-reported data, remarking, quote, as a gay woman, I can confirm that all of the 100% heterosexual women I've slept with have been smoking hot. It's kind of a funny story. Implications of research. I'm thrilled that research is blowing up social media. You often don't hear about that. So there you go. Going back to the Boy Scouts, let's talk about the Boy Scouts yet again. The Mormon Church released a statement this week saying that it was going forward with the scouting program. After the Boy Scouts moved in July to drop its ban on openly gay men serving as scout leaders, after the Boy Scouts of America approved a resolution to end its long-derided ban on gay men, the church sprang into action. We covered this a few weeks ago. They released a statement saying, the century-long association with scouting will need to be examined. But this week, the church sounded much more conciliatory, all while opening the door to discrimination in church-sponsored troops. This is what the statement said, quote, in the resolution adopted on July 27, 2015, and in subsequent verbal assurances to us, the Boy Scouts of America has reiterated that it expects those who sponsor scouting units, such as the church, to appoint scout leaders according to their religious and moral values in word and deed, and who will best inculcate the organization's values through the scouting program. At this time, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will go forward as a chartering organization of the Boy Scouts of America, and as in the past, will appoint scout leaders and volunteers who uphold and exemplify church doctrine, values, and standards, end quote. Zach Walls, the co-founder and executive director of Scouts for Equality, he then issued the following statement. He said, quote, we are heartened by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints' decision to continue working with the Boy Scouts of America and to continue offering the program to its young men. We have maintained from the beginning of our campaign that the values and life lessons of scouting are universal, and we would have been saddened to see hundreds of thousands of youth denied the opportunity to participate in the Boy Scouts. We hope to continue to work to build a stronger and more welcoming Boy Scouts of America with friends and allies across the religious and political spectrum. So, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints staying affiliated with the Boy Scouts, but as the Boy Scouts had previously opened the door to allowing some of their chapters to not allow gay people to serve as leaders, it sounds like that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is going to take them up on that offer. So, good news out of the military. Transgender Americans could be able to serve openly in the United States military by May 27, 2016, so says a report from USA Today. The national newspaper obtained a Department of Defense memo that reportedly lays out a prospective timeline for changing the longstanding military regulation that currently designates self-proclaimed transgender Americans categorically unfit to serve in the armed forces. It says this in the USA Today article. Quote, the memo circulated last week among top personnel and medical officials lays out the roadmap for ending the policy and highlights some of the potential issues, including a pilot program that would provide leaves of absences for transgender troops being treated with hormones or having surgery. The memo also reportedly offers the potential reconsideration of the discharge status of transgender veterans who were separated under the soon-to-be-changed regulation, as well as pondering whether transgender troops would be eligible for deployment in war zones. So it sounds like the Pentagon is moving forward with the Department of Defense to lay out a roadmap for transgender Americans who wish to serve in our armed forces to be able to serve. Don't want to deny anybody that honor. If they are looking for that honor to serve in the armed forces, we want to decrease any and all barriers that are there. Not happy news. So that's good news on the trans front in the military. Not good news. The victim in a deadly shooting near Chicago in March has been identified as a transgender woman, bringing the total number of trans women reported killed in the U.S. this year to 19. In the early morning hours of March 7th, Keisha Blige, a 33-year-old transgender woman, was driving a friend in her car through Aurora, Illinois, when several shots were fired. One shot hit Blige in the shoulder, and though she attempted to drive herself to the hospital, she eventually lost control of the vehicle and crashed into a Jeep. Blige was pronounced dead on arrival at an Aurora hospital at 2:58 a.m. on March 7th. A subsequent report in the Tribune did mention that Blige was transitioning and had recently begun hormone therapy, though the paper continued to use male pronouns. Oh my gosh, do we have work to do in the media? The paper continued to use male pronouns and Blige's given male name. Blige was misgendered by police and media reports that relied on her state-issued identification, but a friend of the victim contacted a newspaper in the United Kingdom to confirm Blige's identity as a trans woman. In March, Aurora Police told the Tribune that the shooting was not considered random but declined to release a motive. When contacted by a newspaper in the United Kingdom, Dan Ferrelli, media relations manager for the Aurora Police Department, said, quote, "It's definitely not a hate crime." He added, "But we have some theories we are looking into." So this is number 19. And this is just number 19 of trans women reported killed in the U.S. There are so many murders that go unreported. By comparison, 12 transgender women were reported killed in the U.S. throughout 2014. We are already at 19 right now. Notably, however, neither of these totals, either in 2014 or 2015, include individuals whose deaths were not reported or investigated, nor for victims who were misgendered or not regarded as trans women in death. So there you go. Number 19. Really, so much work to do. So much work to do to support our trans brothers and sisters. People are actually dying. Actually dying. There's an op-ed over on advocate.com that I very much encourage you to go check out. It is entitled, "We Will Not Be Silent About the Stonewall Movie." The piece was collectively written by the Latino LGBTQ community members from Philadelphia in response to the backlash that queer communities of color have received in voicing their opinions on the racism and transphobia that is rampant in the larger LGBTQ community. So again, we've been covering this, it feels like every week, this movie that's coming out, Stonewall the movie that's coming out. Even Larry Kramer stepped forward, and Larry Kramer has done more good for our community than we could possibly describe. It doesn't make him infallible. And so he stepped forward and told people to basically shut up, which was more than a bit depressing, because there are folks who are really and rightfully outraged at the very whitewashing treatment that Stonewall the movie seems to deliver to the LGBTQ communities of color who were the first to throw bricks there at Stonewall. A little bit from this op-ed, but again, I encourage you to check it out. It's called "We Will Not Be Silent About the Stonewall Movie." Quote, "Over the past several weeks since the release of the trailer for the upcoming movie Stonewall, there have been several op-eds written by distinguished mainstream older LGBTQ white activists shaming or dismissing those of us who intend to boycott the film. The racist and condescending undertones of these op-eds galvanized us, a group of Philadelphia Latino LGBTQ identified individuals, to respond specifically to an op-ed written by Mark Segal of the Philadelphia Gay News and published by The Advocate on why we shouldn't boycott Stonewall the movie. Mr. Segal is amused and angered by the idea of a boycott because, quote, nearly all the people on both sides have one thing in common, they weren't there. He further states Stonewall's perceived lack of acknowledgement of Sylvia Rivera's and Marsha P. Johnson's contributions seems to be the central reasoning for a boycott of the film. This shows a lack of understanding of our own shared LGBTQ history. As Latino LGBTQ individuals living and working in Philadelphia, we acknowledge we were not present during the Stonewall riots of 1969. However, we are here today because of LGBTQ Latino and Black organizers Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, and Miss Major Griffin Gracie, Storm DeLarvery, and many more. Their lives and work justify our anger at the continued exploitation of their stories." And there's a lot more in this op-ed. I again encourage you to check it out. "We Will Not Be Silent About the Stonewall Movie." So, continues and continues. That Stonewall movie is really alienating people in our own community, and it's turning us against each other. And that's never, ever a good thing. Never, ever a good thing. Last month, we covered that Italy is the last country in the European Union to allow same-sex marriage. They still have not officially approved it. Well, it's even worse than we think there in Italy. Speaking in an interview published in this week's edition of the Italian daily La Repubblica, Venice Mayor Luigi Brugnaro said he intended to prevent gay pride parades from being held in the city for as long as he remained in office. He said this, quote, "There will be no gay pride in my Venice." And he described such events as, quote, "a farce" and, quote, "the ultimate in kitsch." He went on to say, quote, "let them go and do it in Milan or in front of their own homes," end quote. I love that this is kind of a turf war between Milan and Venice. Apparently in Venice, it's not going down, so he wants to send them to Milan. Flavio Romani, the president of the rights group RC Gay, which organizes gay pride parades in several Italian cities each year, responded to the comments by accusing the mayor of seeking to impose his personal preferences on an entire city. Romani said this, quote, "Venice is not his city. At the moment, he is governing it, but he won't last long, given the fool he is making out of himself. He's becoming obsessive about this. Venice does not deserve it," end quote. The Veneto region, where Venice is located, holds a pride parade every year. Romani said the event, which is scheduled to return to the city of Canals in 2016, would go ahead despite the mayor's objections. Yeah, apparently Venice, the hotbed of controversy around gay pride parades in Italy, which is the hotbed of controversy in the European Union, as being the last holdout to not allow gay marriage. So that's what's going on overseas. Some really terrible news here in the U.S. Only about 1 in 5 teenage gay and bisexual males in a new study said they'd ever been tested for HIV despite their increased risk of infection. And almost half the teens didn't know where they could go to be tested for HIV. This is what researchers have found. Brian Mustansky of Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago said this, quote, "It's important for all teens to get tested if they're sexually active, but it's especially important for young gay and bisexual men to be tested because they're at such an increased risk of transmission." And Brian Mustansky is the lead author of this new study. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends routine annual HIV screening for everyone between the ages of 13 and 64, and more frequent testing for those at an increased risk. Recent research suggests that testing rates among young adults are low and that gay and bisexual men may misjudge their risk of becoming infected with HIV. So there is this sense of invincibility. We actually just talked about it in class tonight in my diversity in higher education course. We talked about the infallibility, the invincibility that young gay men, young bisexual men are feeling around HIV and AIDS. And that's one of the reasons these rates are so much on the rise. There's this feeling that, oh gosh, we're invincible. And there's also, and this is both a positive and negative, because the face of AIDS has changed, because the actual physical face of AIDS is not what it looked like in the 80s and the early 90s, because there's not this sense that HIV and AIDS is a death sentence. We're not seeing the purple lesions, the Kaposi sarcomas, the face of HIV and AIDS. I mean, gosh, you could participate in the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride and just see pure and utter health. Because medications have come so far, because our brothers and sisters with HIV and AIDS can look so healthy, it's contributing to, I mean, this is what this research indicates, our LGBT brothers and sisters of a younger age feeling like they are invincible. And so they're not getting tested, they're exposing themselves to risk more, and they're not seeing it as the death sentence. And indeed, it's not a death sentence if you have access to medications, which not everybody does. We're not the only country in the world. If we travel abroad, we see in various parts of Africa, certainly in Uganda, where I've traveled extensively, without access to those medications, it is a death sentence. It absolutely is. But here in the U.S., yeah, it's great that people are living out their lives with HIV and AIDS, but that's not an excuse to expose ourselves to higher risk. It's not an excuse to not be tested. So important that everybody get tested. I remember talking about this in a class that I taught last fall with a group of first-year students, and many of them didn't even know that it wasn't a blood test anymore. To get tested for HIV and AIDS, you could get a blood test, but they didn't even know about oral swabs. They didn't even know that you can get your results back super, super quick. I mean, instantaneously in a lot of different clinics, or 20 minutes, or, you know, pretty good turnaround. It's not the week that people think it is. It's not a blood test. So a lot of misinformation out there, a lot of work still to be done, but we have to have these conversations with our LGBT and ally brothers and sisters of a younger age, because tons of work to be done. So I leave you with that. I leave you with that work to be done. Get out there and do that work. Our huge, huge thanks to Seth Sykes. Go check out his show at 54 Below. Our enormous thanks to Carmen Lane. What a treat to have Carmen reading poetry on our show. Get out there and go buy that book of poetry straight away. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. You know how to do it. You just got to get out there and do it. Use your voice, make a difference. And while you're doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?